authority, their excellence, or anyone else in this world except the Holy Prophet, as I said, and Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And this title has not been given to others. I mean, this title of Sayyid, or what we call it, a person who has a high level, high rank, has been given to Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam and the Imams after him, that yes. They are known as Sayyid. That's why even the generation of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayha, they are known as Sayyid, since they are attributed to that pure generation, and then they are known as Sayyid. So
Lady Fatima al-Zahra, you said?
Yeah. The lineage of Siyada, actually, or Sayyids, refers back to the children of Lady Zahra sallallahu alayha and not others. So you see, Siyada has actually started from the lineage of Lady Fatima salam alayha, and not others. So the children of the Prophet from other, those who belong to the Prophet from other people do not have this title.
The Sayyid originally refers to Prophet Muhammad through Lady Fatima al-Zahra.
Very true.
And not Imam Ali?
No. Even, look, those who have been entitled as Sayyid,
yes,
the Holy Prophet himself, and this Siyada has been transmitted through Lady Fatima salam alayhi, but Imam Ali alayhi salam is someone who has been given this title. Right?
So I know what you mean. That's right.
Yeah. But for others, it goes through Lady Fatima salam alayhi. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, exceptionally, he has been entitled as Sayyid.
And
Sayyidul Awsiya.
Yes. And Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein, as the sons of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, are the, we can say,
so
that's right.
Whoever is entitled as Sayyid or Sharif or Habib in the world, in different parts of the world, that belong or are connected to the lineage of the Holy Prophet, they are those Sayyids. But the Sayyids that we are talking here, I mean, this actually title that we are talking here actually proves the concept of Imam, even for Imam al-Islam, from the side of its tawatur or frequently narrated tawatur of this hadith, that is, it has been frequently narrated, and from the side of the literal and esoteric meaning, so it refers to a higher concept or a higher rank, which is the rank of imamate.
That's all right. Again, as we said, Prophet Muhammad Sheikh Rouhani, this is our final minutes of the program. I think through Imam Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is again emphasizing on the concept of the leadership and the imamate in a Muslim and Islamic ummah, isn't it?
Yes,
so
of course.
So through obeying these sayyida, I mean these two agha, these two sayyids, you know, of the dwellers of the paradise, so he is inviting us to follow the imamate too, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, the main purpose and the main objective of our life is what? Is to finally go to the paradise, to Jannah. This is the main objective of our lives. To achieve this objective, we have to find the people of Jannah, those people who surely and certainly will go to Jannah. So among these people, based on these mutawatir hadiths, are these two men, Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. That's why whoever wants to go to Jannah, to be saved from the hellfire, they have to find Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and to follow them. Of course, as you rightly mentioned, it indirectly indicates the leadership and the imamate, that, oh people, if you want to enter paradise, you have to follow these two men, Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salatu wasalam.
Okay.
That's why, since this hadith is narrated by both Sunni and Shiite scholars, I think all Muslims, particularly the Sunni Muslims, should very deeply think about this, that, okay, when we are now living in this world, we have Yazidi kind of or Amawid readings of Islam beside the Ahl Bayti and Shiite reading of Islam. Based on this hadith, then whom should be followed? The enemies of Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam, or Imam Hussein? If Imam Hussein is the people among the people of Jannah, of course the enemies of this Imam will never be among the people of Jannah. That is why if we follow the Amawids, nowadays, their understanding, their reading, their interpretation of Islam, based on this hadith, since they were the enemies of Hussein and Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, We should very, very deeply and very comprehensively think about Islam, about our understanding of Islam, about following whom as Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam. In his time, he many times mentioned this point to all Muslims that you will be asked about Imam, about your Imam. Your Imam will be asked on the day of Qiyamah that whom you follow in this world. Why Imam al-Sajjad always focusing on this title of Imamate? Because of this, that if you follow the wrong Imam, the false Imam, and of course you will never be the people of Jannah and you will never be saved from the hellfire. That's why, of course, this hadith indicates the importance of leadership and guidance, that we have to find the true way or the right path and the true Imams, the true leaders, and the true people of Jannah to be followed by us.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Alavian, for your nice elaboration regarding the prophetic hadith regarding Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In fact, al-Hassan wal-Hussein Sayyidah Shabab al-Ahli Jannah, that Imam Hassan alayhi salam, al-Hassan and al-Hussein are the masters of the youth of paradise to others. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, please visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Every day we are met with a new heartbreak and horrors, says the engineer from Gaza, Sabreen Shabbat. But we remind ourselves that to remain steadfast because we are Palestinians, she adds. Here is a story of a woman who is keen to speak for all women of Gaza.
Sabreen's story isn't just her own. It is the story of all Palestinian women. Not showing her full identity is her way of telling the world she's a faceless face of all Gazan women who've experienced genocide. It's the story of a thousand like her, family-focused, fierce of spirit and of intellect. Sabreen may choose to screen her face, but the full glare of her experience living under tyranny has been exposed for all to see. In what has become something of a theme, Gaza's women are some of the most educated, a feat even more impressive for the obstacles endured just to have the right to learn. Sabreen's hard work was paying off. Despite the challenges, she had ambitions to go further, for more. Life in a genocide is a new kind of horror. Survival is simply the beginning of a nightmarish hellscape. The world's failings on Palestine have been noted, most solemnly by the Palestinians who found themselves living under a genocide as life carried on as normal elsewhere. The act of constant displacement, of leaving everything behind in an attempt to escape with your life, takes a heavy toll. The thing they probably don't tell you about living under the shadow of munitions exploding, bodies being broken, a genocide as your shadow, is how your spirit is beaten, even if your body defies the odds and remains intact. The latest round of Israeli aggression has not just robbed Palestinians of the here and now, but by reducing their lives to the most base elements of survival, Palestinians are robbed of a future filled with hopes and dreams. trauma experienced by those who survived the genocide will require generations to unpack. Mothers, sisters, daughters, sons have all lived through months upon months of a Western-created tragedy one would not wish on their enemies, except perhaps the ones created for political expediency. Sabrine has seen the worst, but strives to live to honor those who are not as fortunate. Sabrine wants us to embrace the things we hold most dear. Create memories. Tomorrow isn't guaranteed, but as long as there's life, there must be hope.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Sabrine's story is Fatima Hilou. She's a British Palestinian filmmaker. Welcome, Fatima. Fatima, this Sabrine talks about the hope and you know, the strength she has, which we've seen in a lot of Palestinians, and to stay steadfast on the path of resistance. But she equates this to her identity as a Palestinian. Now, you as a Palestinian yourself, you know, can you explain this spirit to us?
Well, I share this identity simply because I am also Palestinian, as you've said, and I'm from there. And Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, said, "I come from there. I have a home, I have a window, and a prison." So that is, you know, this is the beautiful and the powerful reflection on identity. Palestinian identity, like any other, is a combination of history, culture, traditional, and the shared experience of a people. But what makes it especially striking is that it has continuously threatened by, you know, displacement, occupation, and attempts to erase it. Yet, despite this, Palestinians have held onto their identity with remarkable strength. It is the embroidery, you know, the embroidered dresses, what every stitch tells the story of a village or a city, carrying the heritage of generations. It is the kufiya, not just a scarf, but a symbol of the resistance, which you are talking about, the struggle and the unity.
Do you feel that the fact that, you know, there is this fight for survival specifically?
Definitely.
That is what makes you more strong?
Definitely. Palestinian identity is not just about culture and aggression and you know, expression. Thought. It is also deeply tied in the land, to the you know, to the names of villages, the streets, the olive trees, the, you know, the stood fasting, the of for the centuries, you know, they've been struggling, and you know, this is the oral history passed down from elders who you know, who remember what, you know, once was, and even for those, you know, exile, it carried, you know, in memory, it carried in language, in belonging for the return. The, you know, Sabrine's strengths like that of so many Palestinians comes from this deep rooted identity. It is the identity, is an identity that has been shaped by the struggle, but also by an unbreakable connection to heritage, to history, and hope. And that's why, no matter, you know, how much hardship they face, Palestinians continue to hold into their traditions, because identity is not just because it's about, you know, past, but also about the future, and the determine of and they determine to protect it.
Absolutely. How much of a faith do you think plays a role here? Because do you think that it is the fact, like, you know, when I struggle to see what is going on in Palestine right now, you know, with the tragedy we see happening, is the way I see it is that, you know, we are all transitional into this world. We only have to think about our role and, you know, what we can do, what are we supposed to do, what really eventually happens and the solution is found, we leave it upon God. You know, do you think this belief in God is probably what also helps in this fighting spirit, in this resilience?
It's more about the strength, you know, like, you know, absolutely, you're right. Sabrine's pain is not just her own. It is reflection of a much, you know, larger struggle, one that history has shown can repeat itself, and in if injustice, you know, going on and, you know, left unchecked, for instance. And today it's Gaza. Tomorrow it could be anywhere. It could be, you know, when Ward turns it, a blind eyes to yeah. oppression, it sets a dangerous precedent, you
Absolutely.
Know, that
yeah.
allows inhumanity
yeah.
to spread. And the loss of innocent lives, children, doctors, youth, people, engineers, like, you know, like Sabrine, is not just a loss for Palestine, but for humanity, for as a whole. You know, these are not the people who shape the future.
Absolutely.
And
we're going to come back to that, Fatima, just
yeah.
to remind our viewers, you are watching Women of Resistance, where we highlight the plight of women who are subjected to a genocide in Gaza. Let's move to a more personal story of yours, Fatima. You are a Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
Every Palestinian has got their own story. You know, tell us about your Palestinian story and the work you do.
Well, I'm a filmmaker. I'm a Palestinian of origin and British citizen. I'm a filmmaker. I'm an activist. I am a survivor. I am you name it, you know, a journalist, and I've been through all what Sabrine's actually been through. I was born and grew up in exile in the refugee camp, the infamous refugee camp in Lebanon called Sabra and Shatila. I witnessed the massacre that happened in September 1982 there. I lost part of my family in the camp. I was forced when I was a child to walk on the dead bodies, you know, when I was, you know, very young, to see all of this atrocity and forced and used as a human shield, you know, mm-hmm. in the camp in order the Israelis to get into the camp. However, that did not stop me. The same as Sabrine said, this is not like going to hold us, but it's going to encourage us. It may, you know, delay us to achieve our hope and our dream. But still, actually, we will do it. Sabrine's case, she went to the university after 18 years of, you know,
yeah.
of staying,
marriage,
you know, looking
yeah.
after
yeah.
her family.
Yeah.
This is amazing. You know, she kept this dream. She kept this
mm-hmm.
resistance and strength. And that where every Palestinian has this encouragement, because
yeah.
we need to create our future. We need to you know, to reach our dream. And that's what it is.
Fatima, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering, it's amazing. And we have seen this repeatedly,
mm-hmm.
this resilience and strength, you know. But sometimes when you've been through, for example, what you say about, you know, walking over dead bodies, this breaks the strongest of people. Sometimes, you know, mental health issues, it stops you from, you know, achieving more. But we don't see that in you, Palestinians. We just see it fueling more and more, you know, spirit of resistance. How do you do it?
We do it actually because we don't have, when you are in this situation, you don't have time to think about it. You need to do it. You need to go for it. You need to keep going. Otherwise, it's gonna break you. And that's why the strength, the commitment, you know, the belief, the resistance is our you know, our weapon to keep going on and to keep our life live, basically, to continue and to go forward and look for the future.
That's
It held you back.
Yeah.
Yes, to get your dream, but that does not stop you. You know, it keeps you going. Otherwise, it will break you.
Because there is no other option than to fight for the freedom of Palestine.
There is no other option,
yeah.
and you have to be unbreakable.
Yeah.
That is the issue. That's the most
yeah.
important for us.
Absolutely.
For
now, how do we help, you know, like women who are in Gaza at the moment in the condition
mm-hmm.
of Sabrine, for example? We see that, for example, she's got this GoFundMe, you know, account.
Yeah.
But she's saying it's not doing too well. People are not really donating money. But you see a lot of, you know, people want to help out. Do you think it's the trust factor of donating online? What really is it?
Well, it's quite a lot of combination. First of all is, you know, the holding of the, you know, the power of the occupation is affecting the contribution for the people and the mistrust. Of course, sometimes they try to break you. They try not to allow you to get any fund. Mm. But also, it's not just this. It's about you know, women need support, especially the Palestinians through organization. They need a contribute organization that dedicate to aiding Palestinian women, not just, you know, keeping them struggling and struggling and going on like that. Mm-hmm. You need a plan for this, and you need an organization, an institution that can adopt these people, like Sabrine, like me, because we are struggling even to do some films nowadays because of the lack of fund, the lack of credibility and trust. We need advocate, we need education for girls and women as well in our you know, culture and our community.
Yeah.
The problem is we have a lot of, as I said, a lot of preventing us. Some of them is like, you know, amplifying, like, you know, we need amplifying the voice of women as well.
Absolutely.
This is very important.
Yeah.
But also, bear in mind, occupation is making it really difficult as well.
Yes.
I'm going to give an example about a lady who was, you know, recently killed in her house in France. She's a journalist. She's a filmmaker. She was doing a film, documentary film about Gaza recently. Her name is Marine Fedhovich. And she was found in her house.
Absolutely.
Tired,
I mean, Fatima, the struggles of the Palestinian women are manifold. There is threats everywhere. But honestly, I have to end this by saying to you, you know, hats off to you, women of Palestine.
Thank you.
And on that, thank you so much for joining us. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
How are we using our wealth? Are we using it in a way that can help the community, can help education, can help other people? Or we are just simply using it for the sake of the betterment of our own, very own personal lives. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all of you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of For a Better Life, where today this is Nahid having the honor of hosting you on another episode. We are going to talk about wealth and the way we are spending the money that God gives us and how we should actually go for the ways of spending it. But before everything, let's go for a very small part of the prose written by Saadi Shirazi, the famous prose writer and poet of Persia, and see the way he is going to put the concept of wealth in the form of the literature, the beauty of literature, while at the same time keeping the Islamic views in mind as a Muslim prose writer. He puts it this way, that say not that no dignity excels that of sovereignty, for no kingdom is more free from care than that of the dervish. They that are the most lightly burdened reach the destination first. The poor man is afflicted by lack of bread, the king by the care of his kingdom. Though one may rule and another may serve, though the one be exalted to the height of Saturn and the other languish in a prison, when death has claimed them, it will not be possible to distinguish between the two. So at the time of death, the time that there is no difference in the positions of any people, not regarding the great samples like our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, wealth is not playing anymore. So what matters is the way we are behaving, the way we are using wealth, even in the service of our betterment in the hereafter as well. So whoever exclaims the verses of Quran trying to find out Islam's perception of wealth, money, good, and all which is of use to man, will certainly conclude that the Quran also regards all the existing things on earth as means to satisfy the human needs and no more. Quran always urges man to cut off his ties with them. That is why it dispraises the love of money, the accumulation of wealth, and the collection of property for no justified reason. Our holy book forbids these harmful practices and decides that money, wealth, and products have an economic role, which they should play in order to keep life going on. It is unacceptable in the perspective of Islam that these things become a target to which we direct all our effort and energies. Islam strictly forbids amassing wealth without investing it in profitable and honorable projects. Employing all available means, Islam emphasizes this critical economic concept. It works to instill it in man as to weaken greediness and large-scale amassing of wealth, and to face up to the economic inequity. The Holy Book of Quran mentions, no, but you honor not the orphans, nor do you urge one another to feed the poor, and you devour heritage, devouring all, and you love wealth with exceeding love. Other verse of Quran puts it this way, that woe, lo, every slanderer, defamer, who amasses wealth and counts it, he thinks that his wealth will make him abide. No, he will certainly be hurled into the crushing disaster. And we have it continued in the Holy Book of Quran. So keep your duty to Allah as much as you can, and hear and obey and spend. It is better for your souls. And whoever is saved from the greediness of his soul, these are the ones that are successful.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Be besides these holy verses of the great book of Quran, which we mentioned, we find a hadith. We have our great imams mentioning the teachings of the Quranic teachings, like repeating the ones that we also can find in Quran, which broaden the horizons of economic thought. These hadith and the sources of Islam can help us understand the notion of money and how we can just use it in the way of the betterment of our life. Like, again, in Quran, we have it mentioned, Allah has certainly given the poor a share of their wealth of the well-to-do, for the paying of which they deserve no praise. It is zakat. Thanks to zakat, the blood of Muslims was spared, and they were called Muslims. But next to zakat, Allah has made a portion of wealth of the rich due to the belonging to the poor. So even one portion of the money and wealth given to the rich people is going to be considered as part of the money given to the poor people. Knowing this, that Allah, the Almighty, the one who had requested us, is not only looking at the poor people at this view, the view that we are talking about is taking the sides of the both. Like, as a rich person, imagine this, a rich person is doing no activities of the Islam, is not following and sharing any of the portions of the money given, the blessings that are given by the Almighty, and they continue to be greedier and greedier. But on the other hand, a person is wealthy enough, is rich with money and with blessings, and now they are also sharing it with the poor people. They are following the teachings of Islam. They are following the zakat and everything that Islam has requested and commanded us towards. These people are better at controlling themselves in the face of greed, and the wealth that they have has more of barakah, has more of the thing that Prophet puts it, the way that mentions their money is going to be more and more increased in a way that's as if God is looking at the money that they are gaining. In his letter to Malik Ashtar, Imam Ali alayhi salam outlines the responsibilities of the Islamic state. He concerns the poor and the rich people. Imam writes to Malik, "Then I want to caution you about the poor. Fear Allah about their conditions and your attitudes towards them. They have no support, no resources, and no opportunities. They are poor. They are destitute, and many of them are crippled and unfit for work. Some of them come out begging, and some who maintain self-respect do not beg. But their condition screams about their distress, poverty, destitution, and wants. For the sake of God, Malik, protect them and their rights. He has laid the responsibility of this up on your shoulder. You must fix a share for them from the government treasury. Even the wealth that is for the Islamic government, which was ruled by the best governor ever, Imam Ali alayhi salam, one part of the money, one part of the wealth is going to be devoted to the poor people based on the reasons that Imam alayhi salam mentions. So even the government treasures considered as the plans and the everything that the government owns is going to be shared by the other people and by the poor people as the most important example too. So with this wish that if we gain wealth, which inshallah we will to the extent that the Almighty wants us to gain, and with this wish, this is more important than gaining the wealth. With this wish that if we have something that is of value, that calls us wealthy, with it comes the feeling and the great generosity. If it's not even generosity, it's doing the duty that God has recommended. Comes this bravery, this power to be generous enough to share with others and to be caring of the religion, of the traditions of our great prophet. With this great wish, let's end today's episode of For a Better Life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of Hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble Imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Peer pressure. Yes, dear teens, we know you are not always surrounded by positive people, good people, or you sometimes come under pressure. And we are here to help you through how you can go with these scenarios. Well, in the previous episode, we reached the conclusion that on that day, people will be crying from the hellfire. Woe to me, I wish I didn't choose this and this particular person as my Khalil, as my friend. So be careful in choosing friends and be careful coming under this pressure because the consequences are very, very bad. And whenever you choose to do something, look at the consequences first. That's just off the previous episode, and we'll continue with the same. Brother Liaqat, again, the stage is all yours.
So, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. When it is said about the verse of the Holy Quran, where a person is going to say, grief be upon me. So he will wish for grief on that day. And the grief is because of choosing so-and-so person and a few friends, example, as a friend in when he was alive in this world or she was alive in this world. So, you know, we, as parents or educators, example, it's a kind of responsibility. I would say it's a wajib responsibility to teach our children, to teach our teens especially, because now that they're going to become baligh, example, or they have passed the stage of bulugh,
right.
They are matured now. And they know what feelings are, example, and they can really distinguish between genders now, and they know what are inclinations and everything, right? So example, when we tell them about smoking, okay, as parents or educators, when we tell them, you know what, smoking is not allowed, okay? It's really something which I don't accept it to happen. Likewise, I don't accept drinking. Likewise, it's not just me, it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's the Ahlul Bayt, it's the Holy Quran. So if you are drinking, example, you're going against everything. It's haram. The concept of haram should be introduced before itself.
Mm-hmm.
Example, the concept of haram should be introduced, I would say, from the childhood itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is haram? What is not allowed? And example, it should be taught to the child in a manner that, you know what, this is something bad, and you know, you are such a good person, and you don't like it. You know how we teach the love of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa sallam? We say the child, you know, the Ahlul Bayt are very good, they are they are very nice,
noble,
and they are from Allah,
kind,
you see,
yeah.
We love them. Likewise, how we are teaching love of Ahlul Bayt to our kids, love of the Holy Quran to our kids, likewise we teach what is not allowed as well. You know, alcohol is very bad, those people are very bad example, you see, and we shouldn't be going to those kind of people, and we shouldn't be listening if they, if someone tells us to, example, go towards it and
a
drink it, example,
thing,
you see.
Yeah.
So when a person gets a list of what a haram, example, and what a haram in today's world are really astonishing, and you know, they are like updated.
Right.
Back in our days, example, like when we are when we were children, this internet and this kind of technology was not available.
Yes.
In those days, like haram was something else. Okay, it was kind of fantasy. Maybe if a person has to go and commit something haram, but in today's world, haram is very easy to be committed. Example, you see.
Right. Yeah. We'll discuss more on that. Let's take a short break here.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor. Allahu Rahim. Allahu Yuhibbul سينين وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Yaqut, you said a very important point before going to the break. You said that in today's world, access to haram is so available, it's so out there. And in like, for example, back in our days, it was the it was a fantasy. The things that was those were fantasies. Our teens today are living those fantasies, actually, and it's really hard to hold back. So yeah, we would want you to give us some strategies so that our teens do not come under this peer pressure. For example, they live in good families, they come from good families, but still the peer pressure is something that sometimes drags you.
Yeah, as parents or educators, example, if we teach them to have patience, just like we teach them to have patience in hardship, if we teach them to have patience if there is a sin in front of us, example, then that will really help us. Just like, you know, of course, we even if we don't use the word patience, okay, if we are just saying you have to get rid of it, you can't go towards it, okay, if we are saying in this manner, it means that, okay, I should be having patience if something is put forward in front of me, like, which is a sin.
Right,
okay?
Right.
So, of course, there are different stages and there are different levels of patience according to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. One of them
is
patience when we are confronted with a sin.
When you have all the grounds.
When you have all the grounds to commit a sin and you still don't want to commit it and you are not committing it. And also patience in obligatory acts, example, patience in hardships.
Well,
everything.
Human is kind of like, he gets tempted, and you know, we are made in a way that we get tempted easily.
Yes.
But it's like, even if your heart wants, even if you feel like, okay, maybe this will give me some kind of pleasure for some time, I'll get some kind of, you know, entertainment for some time, and I don't know, just get out of stress or other things, but when you say to yourself, okay, calm down on this, and that's actually what we call as patience and sins.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? This thing, example, is very important to be put forward in the beginning stage itself. Example, you know, the pressure comes on a teen, okay, for a particular sin, and the sin is not yet tasted by this particular teen, okay? If he or she has already tasted, the tendency to commit the sin or to go under pressure increases. Is a lot, yeah? But example, if the teen has never ever drank alcohol, I'm just giving a simple example, then the teen might say, I don't want to drink it at all. Why? Because the upbringing has happened in such a manner. You know what? The parents or the educators are like, you know what? Alcohol is haram. You can't drink even a drop of it. You can't even taste it. Tasting a drop of alcohol is also haram. Likewise, if we put forward in this manner, if we put forward in front of our teens all the examples, example, the group of people or the group of teens or group of classmates tell something to be searched on website, on social media, which is not allowed according to Islam. If the educator or the parents know this thing and like before itself, they create grounds in order that the teen knows the boundaries. So if we don't train our kids or if we don't do upbringing in such a manner, the teen doesn't know whether this is halal or haram even. He gets pressurized, he commits something.
Maybe I'm getting into
that dark room. That kind of, I would say, desire to commit it once again.
Right.
So it's our responsibility to draw that line before itself.
Right.
So that the teen is not pressurized and is not going to go in that manner.
Right. We'll take a short break and we'll be back in a while.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaqat Abbas is here with us. He is telling us the strategies to overcome peer pressure. Yes.
Yes, sister. So, another example, what happens is a student is pressurized by peers or classmates to cheat on a test. So with friends insisting that everyone is doing it, so they're going to say, oh, you know what? Only you are not
participating
kind of,
in the cheating.
Yeah, exactly. You're not showing your answers. Everyone else are sharing their answers in this in the examination hall. And it's just one time thing. Like, just show it for once. Like, it's just for today. I'm not going to ask you anymore. You see, I'm not going to bother you in the next exam because I know it beforehand. It's, for example, it's an easy subject.
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to that day, again, it's the same thing going on. Again,
yeah.
It's the same cassette or recorder which says, oh, you know what? It's just for today. Show your answers only for today, only for this exam. I promise you, I'm not going to ask. So this is a kind of pressure, again, which is built upon a teen, you see, or a child even. So one thing which we have to, or the student has to remind himself or herself, is about the importance of honesty over here. Number one, importance of honesty. How honest are we towards our examination? And on the other hand, let me tell you very fairly and very frankly, and that is copying, cheating in examination is haram. According to the fatawa or according to the rules of Maraji,
yep.
In Islam, example.
Yep.
Copying, cheating, showing answers, copying answers, looking at answers, copying them on an answer sheet is haram.
Haram.
Simple. Act. Yeah. Be it on an academic level, be it on an Islamic level, be it on whatever level. So copying is haram in examination. So being fair is very important.
Yes.
So you know the boundaries are laid by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over here. Okay.
Yes.
So if someone is asking us to cross those boundaries, of course our intellect will say no. Simple no. Okay, I don't know the answer. So let me be honest with myself. I have to accept the truth that I'm going to get less marks. Or even if I'm going to fail, I have to accept it. Why? Because I didn't learn properly. I didn't train myself in such a manner that I can write answers in a good manner, you see. So I have to be honest, and honesty is very important. And you know what? Honesty is something which should be taught by our parents, which should be taught by our educators. It's okay. Be honest to yourself. Even if you fail in your
even
exam.
Even if the consequences are awkward.
It's okay.
Yeah.
At least you are not going to end up in the consequences of the hereafter.
Right.
If you cheat, you're going to get sin and stuff. At least you're not going to go into that extent.
Right.
You're going to just lose few marks. That's it. You see?
Yeah.
So if
the consequences are going to be small.
Very
and
small.
Right.
And you know, even the parents are going to be like, okay, next time work hard. Like, this time it's okay,
yeah.
But next time, and they are more keen to upon their teen that they progress even more.
Right.
And not fail in the next exam. Yep.
Yes, thank you. That was all the
thank
time
you.
We had for today. Dear teens, remember, Surah Zalzal says, we will be rewarded or punished for the acts which are even of the atom size. So be aware of your actions, and be that through pressure or be that any action, be aware of your actions. Thank you for listening. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The spacious palace with white stones, surrounded by trees and green grass, is the Levadia Palace. It is located in and was once the home of the last Russian Tsar, but is now the residence of a U.S. delegation. Today is February 4th, 1945. In this 116-room palace, three powerful countries are supposed to gather together and discuss an important issue. The flags of the three countries have been hoisted. The troops are all ready for a military reception. Everything is ready, and the ceremonial automobile enters the premises. The first guest is a 71-year-old man. He has a strange addiction to his Cuban cigars. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. It doesn't take long for Joseph Stalin, the host of this major meeting, to arrive. Stalin is a 65-year-old short man with a thin mustache. His first official mission was to organize government and military files. He is now going to sit at this round table and decide about the fate of the world as the leader of the Soviet Union. But the third chair belongs to Franklin Roosevelt. The New York Times wrote about his first 100 days in office as president. He takes power like a dictator. Paralyzed from the waist down due to polio when he was young, Roosevelt could hardly stand on his own two feet without help. However, he has come to this meeting as the head of one of three powerful countries. The theme of the meeting is the future of the world after the Second World War. Adolf Hitler, leader of Nazi Germany, with his trademark mustache, greatly disturbed the UK, the US, and the Soviet Union for his territorial expansion dreams after grabbing power. They had to stand up against him so that their powers in the world would not be debilitated. The alliance of the trio states against Germany achieved the predicted results in World War II. After these three superpowers got involved in the war, the German Nazis' wings were clipped and paved the way for Allied nations to enter this huge palace. They're supposed to talk about the defeat of Nazi Germany and share their achievements from the war. 8 days later, while the three major leaders are standing in front of the cameras, no one knows what lies behind the smiles of the three commanders. Their words are going to change the future of the world. And this story is not an ordinary story. It is a complex story about the future of the largest military organization in the world today, NATO. It was the 28th of July, 1914, when the First World War broke out. Amid the news of the destruction of cities in the war, some news has gone viral among the people. The world's first communist country was born. The country is called the Soviet Union. People in the world have not yet gotten used to the name of this large country when the International Communist Organization is formed with the aim of making the world communist. A great fear arises among the European powers. By now, everyone has understood that communism intends to form a classless society whose economy is controlled by the government and its citizens are under the scrutiny of the government. They have no other goal than to serve the society. just opposite to the capitalist system that is the dominant mindset of Western countries these days. In order to achieve maximum profit, the capitalist system bases the society's administration on free elections and manages the economy, production, and agriculture by private individuals. So it is a serious opponent of communism. These two views will remain in opposition to each other until Germany becomes the dominant power in the world. For this man with his toothbrush mustache, the dream of territorial expansion is not something that would bring Soviet communists and Western capitalists under a united flag. Ideological differences between the two gradually fade away. But just when everything is in place to create a front against the Germans, the UK and France refuse to agree. They do not trust the communists who intend to bring the world under their banner. The Soviet leader is annoyed by this hesitation. Ever since he chose the Russian name Stalin for himself, he became known as Iron Man, an Iron Man who knows very well what decision to make for the communists in critical moments. August 1939, some news spreads in the world. The news shocks the West much more than the news of the destruction of cities in the First World War. The Soviet Union and Germany reach an agreement. The text of the agreement, which is signed on the non-aggression of both countries and the division of Eastern Europe between them, War II. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Everything is going according to the agreement by the two countries, but on June 22, 1941, Hitler orders a massive attack against Soviet territories, an attack that is referred to as the largest and most extensive military attack. Stalin feels completely desperate. He has no choice but to fight the Germans. He now pivots to the West. Stalin desperately needs their help to succeed in the war. Germany's advance in the war scared Roosevelt and Churchill, so they get on board to negotiate with Stalin. However, they're still worried about the consequences of their move. Will Stalin remain loyal to them? No one knows. The only thing they are sure about is the danger of the German army's massive penetration in Europe. Roosevelt and Churchill make their decision. They extend a hand of friendship to Stalin. The private meetings where Roosevelt and Churchill call Stalin Uncle Joe for more intimacy. After news about the alliance spreads around the world, some believe that they have put aside their political differences. But no one knows that heads of these three countries themselves have no decision for this. They get together in their meetings and drink and dine and take photos in honor of one another. But in their minds, they dream and fantasize about defeating each other. Alliance takes its toll on Germany. Hitler is the loser of the war. The US, the UK, and the Soviet Union are the winners. Now they have to sit and once again discuss the spoils of war, of which European territory is the main one. The city of Potsdam will host the Allied states once again. The Allied states that have experienced changes in the past few months. President Roosevelt has passed away. People in the U.S. will replace Roosevelt with his first vice president, Harry Truman.
See, 2144A.
The inexperienced Truman is sent to Potsdam Conference as a chief negotiator. The Americans now know Stalin better. After their new president meets him, they become emboldened and nicknamed the Soviet leader, the Little Bud. Although the Soviet government managed to expand its borders a few hundred kilometers to the west, and establish its dependent regimes throughout Eastern Europe, not all countries under its influence have yet become communist. The US and UK have repeatedly asked the Soviet Union to hold free elections in the Baltic states, Poland, and